Well, we knew each other in elementary school, and you weren't the nicest girl.
Oh, really? What's your name?
My name is John. John Smith.
I don't know any John Smith.
Which elementary school is this?
Yeah.
Turtleneck.
No.
Turtleneck?
I didn't go to Turtleneck Elementary.
That wasn't you in the pink shirt?
Nope.
Oh, what elementary school did you go to?
Kachina Elementary.
Cowlneck?
Cowlneck. Oh, Cowl. Oh, I get it now.
You're so stupid.
My cousin went to that, the Howlneck.
His name was Michael. Fascinating. Is it Michael McKenzie by any chance?
Yeah.
Michael McKenzie's
my
real.
Boyfriend. All right, thanks for calling, mister. Have a good one.
We're really getting off topic here.
This is so much fun.
Pizza
I'm
topping.
So much fun.
Are you really having fun?
Yeah, I can't wait to go home.
Because you look a little bit bored. And you're yawning.
What?
Evidence.
Who cares? It's tiring. I had a beer. Now I just like want to get in the bed.
Look at me. I only had half a beer.
I'm going upstate tomorrow.
Why? To the farm?
To Hudson.
To Hudson?
Hudson Valley, I guess?
This is an art thing?
No, I'm going horseback riding.
You're going horseback riding? Why?
Strawberry picking or berry picking or something.
You don't know?
Because my friend moved there, so we're going to visit her.
Which friend moved there?
This chick, Caitlin.
I don't know any Caitlin.
No, you don't. Anyway, call us at 201-209-9368. We want to know who you want to have hate sex with.
Tell her she's my new hate crush.
Alberto on the comments board says Whitney Houston.
Ugh.
Billy Mays?
Isn't he dead? He was the one in infomercials?
Oh, yeah.
Or is he the ShamWow guy? I'm a little bit confused. Who went to jail for beating up a prostitute?
I don't remember.
Which is
hot. Didn't like someone bite his tongue off or something?
I don't know. One of them was like something fell out of an overhead bin on a plane and that killed him.
I thought he died.
I think that's who I'm thinking of. Oh. And the ShamWow guy is a separate, pathology.
But he's equally crazy, right? Who's the one that someone bit their tongue and they got in trouble in Miami with a prostitute?
Well, wasn't that Mike Tyson?
No.
He bit Evander Holyfield's ear off?
No, he bit an ear.
But in Miami, right?
I don't know where it was.
Don't we have another call to take?
But it was awesome.
Okay.
Actually, we do know.
Kesha. So you bit Kesha's ear.
FMU, you're on the radio.
Yeah, I would like to have hate sex with Peggy Hill.
Peggy Hill.
Oh, the mom on that show?
Yes, King of the Hill, Peggy Hill.
Oh.
She's awful.
In what way?
She's naggy, and she has these weird little euphemisms for the things that she thinks that make her special. Like, a Peggy and meatballs. It's just terrifying.
Oh my god,
awful.
That's so stupid.
And, ultimately, my prized possession is my pillow.
And what do you have on your walls?
I don't have a lot on my walls. It's kind of sad. Yeah, barnacle.
Barnacle.
Yeah, we have a painting of barnacles.
Yuck. Okay, thanks for calling.
You just go out and get real barnacles.
Have a good one.
Wow.
Is it time?
Where's your god now?
I don't know. I feel kind of deflated after this show. I feel like my soul has been sucked.
We do
out
have
of
4 minutes to go, so
do we need to.
Yeah, even if we have no calls, we just need to chat happily for 4 minutes until it's time to end the show.
So, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to a hockey tournament. My son's hockey tournament.
It's boring.
Well, I have to pretend to enjoy it, right, Jack? He's downstairs
could be
listening.
Hearing this.
Yeah, he is hearing this. I know that. It's a joke.
Mark says it wouldn't do any good to hate F Ann Coulter because every F of hers has been a hate F. Someone just said my mom.
I think they mean their mom, not your mom.
Next week's topic, necrophilia. Just kidding.
So was this a good topic, Frangry?
I had a good time.
Because we thought about it and we, kicked it out.
We were afraid of it. Call us at 201-209-9368. Who do you want to have hate sex with? FMU, you're on the radio.
Ken warned us against it.
Hi, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Douchebag. Ken didn't warn us anything. Forget him. I don't think he knows what he's talking about half the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, do you like the new carpet in here?
So who am I giving the prize to? Miriam, who wants to hate sex her dad. I almost said the hate F-ful word there.
Well, don't worry. I've had my finger on the button the whole show.
Or Mike, who wants
my
to
arm's
hate
getting tired.
F the flow, the progressive auto insurance chick.
I'm just not seeing it. I think you should give it to me. Mine's the best answer.
What was your answer?
Laura Ingraham.
Me?
No.
Oh.
Laura Ingraham. You're no Laura Ingraham in the 80s.
But you hate me.
I don't hate you.
Yeah, sometimes.
And you've got that big butt going on.
The Kardashian butt.
Well, not quite that.
It's getting there.
Grand. Well, one, you can always hope.
In these pants. Call us 201-209-9368. You have 3 minutes to be my winner. We want to know who you would have hate sex with.
I frankly haven't noticed what you're wearing today. I loved the dress last week.
I know. It was the first time you ever complimented my outfit.
No, not the first time.
My mullet dress. You just liked it because it was see-through.
Well, the first time in a long time, but not the first time.
That's true. You do say it was nice sometimes.
Yeah.
But usually you just make fun of them.
Well, that's a form of compliment too, right? Because I'm noticing.
You're hate
and I'm
loving
commenting.
My outfit.
I'm hate loving your outfit. That's right. I'm partially mocking it in admiration. Get it?
Yeah, okay. Is it time to stop this fiasco? All right, so I'm going to give it to... I can't decide.
You can't decide. You have to decide.
I think Miriam, who wants to hate F her father, is pretty good.
You know what? To not decide is to decide.
Miriam, you can email me your mailing address and t-shirt size at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org.
And just in case, we have ladies' sizes as well.
No, we actually don't anymore.
No, we do. I thought we did.
No, we don't.
I thought we had a whole bunch left
no,
over.
No, Andy, we gave them away because no one wanted them.
Really? What do you mean we gave
okay,
them away?
Okay, can we move on?
You mean like end the show?
Yes.
All right, is there any last thoughts you want to share before
we
end the show?
I think that we pretty much shared too much today.
We said too much
we
already?
We said too much already, yes.
Michelle's just entered the studio to start up the next show. Michelle, would you like to say anything on our topic tonight? No, she doesn't want to say anything.
I wouldn't either.
You have been listening to Shut Up Weirdo with Andy and Frangry. You can comment during the show next week, not this week, it's too late, at WFMU.org. You can visit ShutUpWeirdo.com, our website, which has got all the links you'd ever want. The Facebook, the Twitter, to iTunes, archives. People need to know this.
Yeah, it's true.
Like us on Facebook, please. We're so close to 1,300.
Wow, who cares? Okay, come
I
on.
Care. Up next is Stuff You Should Know, 8 p.m. Pour yourself a glass of Mr. Fine Wine. You are listening to The Bland One, WFMU East Orange, WFMU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org. So let's...
end it here.
It's time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that exposes the internal workings of life on this planet. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, two anthropology-oriented episodes as Josh and Chuck discuss whether or not there are any undiscovered tribes of people left in the world. And then in part two, they discuss the Japanese military tradition of samurai. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Bryant.
I'm always there for you, Josh.
Yeah, as always.
Yes.
How's it going?
I'm contractually obligated to be.
I know. So, Chuck, you doing all right?
Yeah, dude. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
It's Thursday. It's not Friday, but...
it's a little gray out for my tastes.
Yeah.
It's sprinkling, by the way.
I thought it was like pouring rain. Is it just sprinkling?
It's sprinkling.
Yeah, that's good.
So, Chuck, do you remember, can we go back a year or so? Okay. May 2008?
How many years after Ghostbusters?
Let's see, hold on. What was it, 84 or 86?
84, and yes, we do know that there is a...
It's 24 years.
A sequel coming, by the way.
Yes, Ghostbusters 3.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be awesome.
Should be.
The entire original cast.
I believe so.
Except for Sigourney Weaver, which, that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ghostbusters 3 coming out.
Right. So where are we?
So we're 24 years after Ghostbusters.
Right.
May 2008. And the news cycle had this kind of strange occurrence where a bunch of undiscovered human beings were splashed across the front pages of newspapers everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Sort of.
Yeah. So there's this photo. There's several photos of these people living in primitive huts.
Uh-huh.
Actually, primitive longhouses is what it looks like.
Yeah.
And they are it's an aerial photo taken from a low-flying helicopter, and they are pissed.
Yeah.
They're like aiming their bows and arrows at the camera.
Did
like,
you see the picture? It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
They're like, get out of here.
Right.
Like this whole thing made the news cycle. And Chuck, I take from what you said before we started recording that you have a tad bit of disdain for the, let's say, journalism that was applied to this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, should we go ahead and refute it?
Why not?
Because they were not, in fact, undiscovered people.
No. And there's actually a huge, huge distinction between undiscovered people
right.
and uncontacted or isolated people, right?
Right. But you would not know that by reading The Independent from London.
Which I'm disappointed because I like that paper. No, I'm sorry. I could care less about The Independent. The Guardian I like.
Yeah, you like The Guardian.
Yeah.
Not The Daily Mail, The Independent.
Right.
Here's how the article opens up beneath the picture of the, clearly savage
loincloths and everything
with the arrow pointing at the helicopter.
Right.
Three near naked figures are visible in the forest clearing. Two of them are men, their bodies daubed with a red dye, and they are aiming their bows at the sky. A third figure appears to be a woman, her body blackened and only her pale hands and face betraying her natural color. This remarkable photograph is the first proof of existence of one of the world's last uncontacted tribes.
Yeah.
So they do say uncontacted.
That's good.
But
not everybody did, though.
Sure. It's a little overblown.
That was a fine dramatic reading there, Chuck.
I think the funniest thing that would have happened is if he would have shot that arrow and it would have somehow disrupted the propeller of the helicopter.
Right.
And it would have, landed safely on the beach for them to be eaten.
Yeah.
That would have been a nice ending.
There are tons of rumors of cannibalism about undiscovered
sure.
people, right?
Mm-hmm.
In this specific case, there is a guy named Carlos Dos Reis Mireles. My Spanish is a little rusty, but I think that's about right.
Not bad.
He is an Indian expert. I just made air quotes. And these photos were taken in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
This guy led the search for this tribe,
mm-hmm.
right? And I guess he kind of watched with horror, hopefully,
yeah.
as they were described as undiscovered and no one had ever found them before. He came out and was like, wait, no, I've been following these people for the last 20 years.
Right.
So they're not undiscovered.
See, I thought that was part of the ploy for him. Was he taken aback by that, you think? I thought maybe that's how he got the funding to get the research team by saying they were
undiscovered. It could go either way.
We'll find out.
Well, let's talk about it. Is it even possible to be undiscovered?
Well, that's what this podcast is about, buddy. And you know what? It's kind of impossible these days.
Yeah. We have things like GPS.
Mm-hmm.
We have things like heat sensors that can be attached to airplanes.
Sure.
Which, body heat sensors.
Yeah, yeah.
There is almost complete and total encroachment and harnessment of any square parcel of land on the planet.
Yeah, most everywhere.
Most. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people who live outside, I guess, the fringe, who live primitively.
Yeah.
And remain in a, I guess, primitive state. These are the uncontacted people.
Yeah, isolation, basically. They call them undiscovered, then they say uncontacted, and then they finally settle on isolated.
Right.
Which means, more than anything, is they don't want any part of us.
Yeah. And
not that we don't want a part of them, because we're always interested.
We are, and usually with,
intent.
Murderous results, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, these people have learned the hard way, and some of these uncontacted tribes also, we should say, we have no idea what they call themselves.
Right.
So there's a group actually called Survival International, and they are dedicated to preserving indigenous ways of lives.
Yeah, for these tribes. It's
for
awesome.
For uncontacted tribes who've rejected modernization, right?
Indeed.
Because that's the thing, you think about it, when it's undiscovered or they're uncontacted, you kind of point it out. We just tend to think like, oh, well, they don't know about civilization.
Right.
Or, these poor fools, they don't know about, television or
Running
Grand
water.
Theft Auto 6.
Right. And they would clearly be better off if we gave them TV or made them Christians or did whatever, made them slaves.
Yeah, which we have a fine, fine tradition of doing.
Sure.
And who's this kid who wrote this? Patrick Kiger?
Yeah, never heard of him.
I hadn't either, but he's pretty good.
Yeah.
He does say that it goes back to Columbus. It goes well back before that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The Portuguese in particular loved to enslave Africans.
Yeah.
And actually, African tribes used to enslave one another. They had a completely different method and system of slavery. Slaves were treated much better among African tribes, especially West African tribes, to where they would eat at the same table as the people that owned them. And, of course, the Romans used slaves.
Yeah.
The Jews spent a good portion of their history as slaves to the Egyptians.
Sure.
So, I mean, whenever we come upon new people or subjugate them, we have a history of enslaving them, like you
said.
Yeah,
we tend to conquer. Like Chris Columbus met the very friendly Arawak people.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, well, we can learn from them, he thought they would make really good servants.
Right.
Look how hardworking they are.
Yeah.
And they don't even speak English, so who cares?
Right, exactly. Well, they were also looked upon as savages or less than human, which definitely aided the subjugation of their I don't know, blood?
Right. Do you know why?
Why?
Because back before everything was discovered and there was still a lot of undiscovered land and they were making maps, the map makers would often chart these undiscovered lands as being filled with, you know, mutant human beings and scary beasts for some reason.
Right, like here there be monsters because we haven't gotten around to mapping this area yet. So just assume that there's some sort of water serpent that's going to eat your boat.
Yeah, I guess I don't know why they tended to strike fear into people, into explorers, instead of saying there might be very friendly people. Maybe caution?
Fear of the unknown.
You think so?
Sure.
But Josh, these days, virtually every corner of the Earth has been explored except for, obviously, parts of Antarctica. And Amapa, which I had never heard of.
Oh, where is it?
In Brazil. And they said that 70% of this territory in northern Brazil is still unexplored forest.
Right. So it's possible there are undiscovered people out there.
Maybe.
Right. If there are undiscovered people out there, they are in big trouble. Because if the uncontacted or isolated people are any indication in their plight, then, yeah, any undiscovered people are really kind of screwed.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about Chris Columbus and, and subjugating people. And actually, Columbus was quite the little genocidal maniac.
He was. We covered that in one of the other podcasts, too.
We did. We did. Because not only did he enslave them, he killed them, had them killed. Like, entire groups of people are assumed to have been wiped out by European colonization. And not just through brute force, but this type of genocide, and especially if you look at a genocide as the by its definition, that it's the systematic wiping out of a group, right? Like a people or a population, then it still continues today, as recently as the 80s.
Sure.
The 90s in Brazil.
Are you talking about the microbes? Or are you talking about outright violence?
Violence.
Okay.
Specifically against the Akunzu.
Yes, Josh, the Akunzu, who seemed like a friendly tribe that grew corn and hunted in remote Brazil for thousands of years until they were discovered, and it was discovered that their land could be used for soy cultivation and cattle.
Right. So, and logging, actually, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the companies put in logging roads and into this virgin territory where the Akunzu lived, and they actually came upon them. And it's part of Brazil's constitution that the moment you meet an uncontacted tribesperson or an undiscovered person, all work stops. So what the logging companies and the soybean farming concerns and the cattle ranchers did was hire assassins, like death squads, when they did meet the Akunzu, and sent them in and actually massacred them with guns. These people use bows and arrows, and these guys came in with machine guns and killed all but seven of the entire tribe.
Yeah, then they fled. Sadly, they fled. And just last year, a newspaper reported that there were only five living Akunzu in the world.
Right. And that was 1990. No. That wasn't 1492 or 300 AD.
Very shameful.
Yeah.
But they are not, Josh, the most isolated tribe, according to Survival International, are they?
Right, no.
That would be the Sentinelese. Had you ever heard of these guys?
No, I hadn't. And I saw that video you sent me. There's a clip on YouTube.
Yeah.
I think, did you just search the Sentinelese and
that
came up?
There was a couple of clips.
All right.
I think Nat Geo went down there and they did the same thing. They came out of the jungle onto the beach, and what it looked like in the video, or is their interpretation, was they were making friendly gestures, I did see another one where they had the bow and arrow out.
Yeah.
And I was laughing though when I was watching it earlier. Part of me expected like hippie Rob to come out as their leader. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's like the god. He's like Brando in Apocalypse Now.
Exactly. And the Sentinelese, Josh, where are they? They are believed to be descended from the very first humans in Africa.
And technically we all are, but these people are directly descended from the first group that migrated out about 60,000 years ago, right?
Yep.
They live on the Andaman Islands in the Indian Ocean. And did you notice how clear that water was and how white those beaches were?
I wouldn't leave either, dude.
It was gorgeous.
Who needs TV and Xbox when you've got that, you know?
Right. So these people will come out of the jungle if you throw coconuts into the water at the beach.
Right.
That's what they were doing, right?
Oh, was it?
Yeah. This group of people were sitting there throwing coconuts into the water, and the Sentinelese came out and were like, thanks for the coconuts.
Well, they probably thought it's raining coconuts from the giant monster.
Yeah.
But they are actually not primitive Stone Age folks from what they say.
No.
Survival International says they're actually... do make tools and weapons from recovered metal from shipwrecks.
Right.
Pretty cool.
They are actually not threatened. They're very isolated and relatively uncontacted.
Right.
But they're not threatened. They live on an island that no one really has any interest in, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But as we saw with the Akunzu, though, if there is money to be made off the indigenous land...
Yeah.
You're in trouble.
Soy, oil,
yeah,
cattle.
Survival International actually named all of those: oil, farming, mm-hmm. cattle, and logging, as the dominant threat to uncontacted tribes.
So sad.
There's supposedly an estimated 100 uncontacted tribes in the world.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised.
That's a lot.
And it's sad that these people are around for 60,000 years doing their thing. Doing their thing long mm-hmm. before us, and we just come in and say, "Hey, this would make a great soy farm, so I'm going to massacre you."
Yeah, they heard about the bailout, and they're like,
"Right,
we're staying here,
not for us."
No, so there's five regions that are under the greatest threat right now, and they're in Brazil, Paraguay, and Peru. And actually, there's tons of evidence. There's groups dedicated, like Survival International,
right,
and other NGOs, and then there's actually government ministries set up in Brazil and in Peru and I think Paraguay that are in charge of keeping track of these uncontacted tribes, which is really difficult to do.
Sure.
And a lot of times these uncontacted tribes are slivers, offshoots of other tribes
right.
that have had their land disturbed by logging or mining uh-huh. or oil companies.
So they would join up with another tribe? And
no, they'd just take off into the forest.
Oh, and start a new tribe.
No one would know how many there were, that kind right. of thing. But yeah, they would be living primitively, but they're getting pushed further and further out
right.
or being massacred or... they're coming into contact with disease, right?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about with the microbes. Violence is obviously a big threat, but they say that a bigger threat are these tribes that lack immunities to these awful diseases that 20th century man has.
Right.
21st century man, excuse me.
Sure, it's the future.
I'm
remember.
Living in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually that favorite book of mine, 1491.
Oh, yeah.
By Charles C. Mann.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about how there's an estimated 100 million people living on in the Americas in 1491. And then I think 90% were wiped out by smallpox.
Thank you.
Like within a few decades.
And Josh, it didn't just happen way back then.
No.
Like you said, in the 80s, some Christian missionaries... made contact with the Zoe tribe in Brazil, and in pretty short form, 45 members of that tribe died from the flu, malaria, and respiratory diseases.
Yeah.
Just like that.
And more recently, in 1996, half of the Marunahua tribe, I think in Brazil, they were contacted by illegal loggers,
right.
and half of the tribe was wiped out. From respiratory illnesses, I think.
Awful. So it's not like, to bring up one of our favorite movies again, it's not like bringing orange soda to the Waponi Woo. Joe versus the Volcano.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like that in real life.
I thought you were talking about The Gods Must Be Crazy.
No, another good one, though.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But it's not like the Joe versus the Volcano. It's not all happy-go-lucky. They usually make contact with them, and even in the case of the Christian missionaries, they were trying to do good, I guess, and ended up killing a lot of them. And the Brazilian government stepped in and actually kicked them out, the religious group, and said, "No, you got to get out of here."
Yeah. And apparently, even when the thing is, when contact is made as safely as possible and there's a medical contingency plan in place, it's expected that a lot of the tribes people will die.
Right.
But if they're made through illegal loggers or a Christian missionary group that doesn't know what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
then, a lot of people die, if not the entire group.
Right. That tribe did recover, though, we should note.
Yeah.
Which is good news. Said, get out of here, Christian missionary, so we can live peacefully and healthfully.
So, Chuck, is it good to even contact these people?
Well, it can be good and bad, because obviously if you make contact and you know a little bit about their way of life, you can protect them. But it's also, like this newspaper article, it also opens them up to being invaded or watched, or in this case, what was the tourism trip? Tell them about that. That's awful.
Savage tourism?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, the guy who was responsible for leading the expedition that produced those photographs that made the paper in 2008... was apparently approached by travel agents who wanted him to set up a savage tourism trip.
It's awful.
Which, can't you just see a bunch of fat, white Germans and Americans like, "Ooh, I want to touch you." You know? Now your whole tribe's wiped out.
And now let's get back on the cruise ship and look at the ice sculpture.
Like I said, Brazil has it in, it mentions uncontacted and undiscovered people in its constitution, in large part because of that 70% of unexplored forest in that one territory. They have a real you don't have that in America. Like, we don't have to worry about how to treat undiscovered tribes. We figured out how to treat the ones we're familiar with badly enough.
Right.
But so Brazil apparently recognizes that, like, hey, this is your land. Right? And you legally own it. If you're an uncontacted or isolated tribe, nobody can touch it, but then has a really terrible history of following through on stopping people from going in and logging and oil. Peru's history is even worse. They have some uncontacted tribes, some threatened uncontacted tribes.
Right.
And Peru's president is like, I'm not even sure they exist. And by the way, the French oil company that's working in this area where they supposedly exist, I've now just decreed that their work is a national necessity. So when you're an uncontacted tribe and you're butting heads with an oil company, you're going to lose.
Yeah, I would say so.
But I will say, Paraguay,
hats
off to Paraguay. Because they actually, the environmental, nice, Chuck just took his hat off too. The environmental ministry revoked the license of a ranching concern that was just decimating.
Oh, really?
And I don't mean it in the literal, like, removing 10% term.
Right.
I mean, like, decimating.
All you Latin speakers out there.
This land that technically belongs to the indigenous uncontacted tribes there. So
they booted them out, or they just took away their permits?
They took away their permits, which is pretty much tantamount to booting them out.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's just so sad that when, such a modernist point of view to see these undiscovered or uncontacted peoples and think that they're savages and that their way of life is savage and primitive. It's just, they were here first.
Well, I mean, we were all here first. We were all here at the same time, but it's just a complete lack of recognition of other people's choices.
Yeah, and a respect for other cultures and ways of life. And
again,
that didn't fly around here.
There's no Grand Theft Auto in the jungle.
No, there's not.
No.
There's no auto.
If you want to learn more about people, undiscovered or otherwise, you should try typing in people in the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com. It brings up a hidden subchannel.
Really?
Yes. I guess since I said hidden subchannel, that means it's time for what, Chuck? Listener mail?
Yes, Josh, it is. And before we do that, we want to send a thank you to Dan of the Pottery Dan.
Mm-hmm. Dan Made.
Dan Made. He has a little Etsy website, danmade.etsy.com, and he makes pottery, and he sent us some really awesome coffee mugs.
Yes, Dan Made.
Very cool mugs, and actually that's my work mug now. That's what I use.
I noticed.
Cool detail. You got an octopus on yours.
With a pipe.
Oh, did I have a pipe?
Smoking a pipe.
I can't tell what mine is. It's some little dude, but it's just got cool details. It's got swirls in the bottom
and
little indentions.
And only some parts of it are glazed and others raw. It's really, Dan Made knows what he's doing.
Yes, he does. So thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thank you.
And you know what you wanted to bring up? People have been sending us little gifts, and it's just really nice to come into work and have someone, What was her name that sent us the Twinkie, the homemade Twinkie the Kid shirts?
I don't remember her name.
Ugh.
It was like Kaya or something like
Kyla,
that?
Kyla, I believe.
Okay.
She should write in because I told her that I would mention her little website too.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we got Twinkie the Kid t-shirts because remember we talked about how badly we wanted some?
Uh-huh. So with that, listener mail. All right, I'm going to call this organ donation details from someone who knows. Hi, Josh and Chuckers and Jerry. I'm an anesthesiologist who specializes in organ transplantation, specifically livers and kidneys. In fact, we performed a liver transplant just last night, and I'm home resting after what is always an exhausting procedure. He thought we might want a few more details about organ donation, so he says this. They do not get to meet the donor and the recipient until after a period of time, usually a year, and only after both agree to meet. But we also had people that wrote in and said they met like weeks later.
Huh.
So it might vary by hospital or state.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Or maybe there's just an agreement you go into. But he says they can trade letters and get very basic, unidentifiable information about each other, but it all gets censored by the organ procurement organization. This is because if this recipient does not live or the organ fails, the recipient or donor won't blame the donor or and their families. Also, if the organ works, they don't want the parties involved feeling unduly indebted to the donor. After all, it's supposed to be a free gift with no strings attached. After they have both had time to adjust to their new lives and agreed and prepared to meet, they can meet. That being said, people can still find each other if they are looking and turn to the same websites specifically designed to link donor to recipient, although it is strongly discouraged. So maybe that was the deal. They did it surreptitiously.
Yeah.
So I thought your listeners...
Somebody came up with the website to make money off of people who want to meet the people who donated a kidney to them.
What a great world we live in. I thought your listeners would want to know this, and I hope it encourages would-be donors that they don't have to meet the recipient if they think it would be too difficult. Regards, Todd.
Thanks, Todd.
The anesthesiologist.
Yeah. And didn't he say that it's like you die very easily if you're over anesthetized during a liver
procedure? He has a PS here. If you want to know why an anesthesiologist would need to specialize in liver transplantation, ask yourself if you would like to wake up during a procedure where patients don't tolerate anesthetics very well, and if you would like your new liver to have something to cleanse.
Yeah,
that's what he says.
Very mysterious, Todd. I just asked myself that and I have no answer.
I don't either.
So if you bring people to the brink of death and you want to tell us about it, or if you make money off of genuine human kindness, we want to hear your ploy.
Sure.
You can write in an email and send it to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode entitled Are There Undiscovered People? Originally podcast at howstuffworks.com on January 28th, 2010. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast. Now for part two, Josh and Chuck examine samurai warriors. This episode was originally podcast on June 17th, 2010.
Hey, and welcome to, actually, konnichiwa, and welcome to the podcast. Yeah, I had no idea what samurai were all about.
I didn't either.
Yeah, I knew that they were excellent swordsmen.
Sure.
I vaguely had some sort of conception from Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was, like, the whole Wu-Tang Clan phase that I went through for a while.
Sure.
But that's really about the limits of my understanding of samurai until now, because we've been meaning to do this for about 17, 19 months now.
Not true.
And we've researched it just about every week. So if we fail on this one...
Yeah.
It's
seppuku for us.
Exactly. Nice one.
Thank you.
Chuck, let's talk about the history of the samurai.
Okay, Josh. I have a prepared joke. Should I say it?
Yeah.
No one is quite sure who the first samurai was, Josh, but we all know who the last one was.
That's pretty good.
And he was short.
Yeah, he was real short and is still.
I didn't like that movie. In the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, Josh, there were a bunch of rivalries going in Japan. And a bunch of wars.
Yeah.
It was not a very good place to be. And a lot of these wars, most of them, in fact, were against the islands, the people who inhabited the islands of Japan, mm-hmm. which the Imperial Japanese called Imishi.
Which means barbarians.
And, yeah, they were tough dudes, apparently.
Yes, they were. And they were pretty good at riding horses, right?
Yeah, were they the ones that were the riding archers?
They were, and so were another group from the plains called the Kanto people. And the Kanto tribe actually were kind of in charge of fighting the Amishi. And the Kanto and the Amishi were really good at riding a horse, shooting a bow and arrow at the same time.
Not easy.
No, it's not easy.
Not at all.
And actually, the earliest samurai did this. This is what they were modeled on. They were horseback archers.
Right.
And that whole school of discipline that you identify with samurai grew out of the kind of training it takes to be able to ride a horse and accurately shoot someone in the throat with an arrow.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And if to practice shooting someone in the throat with an arrow while you're galloping past them, what did they used to use, Chuck?
This is a bad and a good. The bad was they used dogs, running dogs.
Yeah.
Which was awful. The good news is, even way back then, the Shogun came along and said, no more dogs.
Right. He said,
it's chickens. A cruel thing. And oh, did he really? And yeah, they didn't use the dogs as target practice anymore.
Right.
Animal rights way back then.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
And so originally the samurai was, like we said, based out of these horseback archers, but horses played a big role in the lives of the samurai. And this code that we'll get to more in depth, it's called Bushido, was grown out of another kind of code or a way of living called Kyuba no Michi. Man, do you know how many times I've said that in my head? And now that I say it out loud, it's Kyuba no Michi. Right?
Yeah.
Which means the way of the horse and the bow, which basically, if you were dedicating yourself to being a horseback archer, that was your life. That's all you did. You lived, ate, and breathed it.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
So that kind of discipline formed the foundation of the samurai outlook, the samurai way of life, the samurai super toughness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice work. They're also an elite warrior, and that status sprung from the fact that there were powerful families that lived way out far away from the capital, and they would like pass their land down and their prestige from one generation to the next over hundreds of years. So there were these warrior houses, and they attained noble status. You combine that with the Amishi barbarian and the code,
The Kyuba no Michi.
Right, the warrior code.
Right.
And basically that was the formation for the early samurai.
Right. And the reason that you had all these warrior clans was because, like you said, the early millennia, the first half of the first millennia, was a really dangerous place. Lots of civil war, lots of land grabs, lots of just general butchery.
Yeah, power shifts.
Japan. Sure. So these powerful clans grew out of this, and they started basically cultivating samurai. And one of the key characteristics of samurai is pretty much the opposite of ninja. You remember when we did the ninja podcast?
Yeah.
They turned on whoever hired them if somebody came along and offered them more money. Not so with the samurai.
No, they serve their master, the daimyo. Is that how you pronounce it?
I believe so.
Okay. They serve their daimyo with absolute loyalty, even if that meant death. And didn't you already say it means one who serves?
I didn't. Did you?
Maybe I just imagined that.
No.
Samurai means one who serves.
Right. And that was actually, funny enough, originally applied to bureaucrats.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then it was ultimately applied to samurai, which little by little, there's all these different foundations that finally come together. In, I think, the 12th century, when these two clans, these two warrior clans that were vying for power, the Taira, T-A-I-R-A, we're going to go ahead and say the Taira clan,
right,
and the Minamoto clan basically came together and clashed. And in 1192, the Minamotos won. And this the head of the household, Minamoto Yoritomo, how do you like my Japanese now, huh?
It's really good.
Yeah. He said, okay, you know what? We now run Japan. The emperor said, hey, way to go. I'm going to make you shogun,
which is essentially the head of the Joint Chiefs, the yeah. head of the military.
Yeah, that kind of backfired on him.
What did Minamoto do?
He said, hey, thanks for making me Shogun. I'm going to take over and strip you of all your power.
Right, and if you say one word, I'll cut your head right off of your body.
Right.
And so what happened was the Minamoto clan set the samurai up for this elite status that they never had before.
Yeah, they were servants before.
Exactly. They served the daimyo. And there was still an entire class of lower echelon samurai who served the daimyo.
Right.
But then the daimyo, these feudal lords, served the shogun.
Right.
So it went shogun, daimyo, samurai.
Right.
And then everybody else.
Right.
And The Minamoto clan, who set up the shogun, the government that they ran was the Bakufu.
Yeah, that was a dictatorship, basically.
Right, and that was the last time the samurai really changed. From that point on, the modern samurai was born.
Right.
Right?
Yes. So, Josh, we've talked about how they formed.
Yes.
Should we talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of what makes a samurai?
I think we should.
If you're talking samurai, you cannot skip the armor. The lamellar armor, yeah. It's called. And you've probably seen it before. It's made by binding metal scales together on a plate, and then they cover it with lacquer to waterproof it. And then all these little light plates are fashioned together by leather strapping.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the armor that distinctively you've seen on a samurai.
You know, it's weird. I just wrote an article about skin disorders, and there is a skin disorder called lamellar ichthyosis,
really? Huh.
Which is basically like fish scale skin disorder.
Oh, there you have it.
Yeah.
Full circle.
Yes.
There were two kinds early on. The yori, which was the mounted samurai. It was a lot heavier with the heavy helmets and shoulder pads and stuff.
Right.
Then the domaru, which was lighter, obviously, for the foot soldiers. And then later on, the gusoku in the 16th century. And that's what this dude is wearing right there.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool picture that you got by Juan Cal. Call?
Yeah.
C-A-L-L-E.
I didn't even see there was a credit there.
Yeah, that is a pretty cool illustration. And did you see that MoMA link I sent you? Or the picture from the MoMA exhibit?
No.
There's a MoMA exhibit of...
I did, yes.
Yes, of the guy who had the black lacquered deer antlers yeah. coming out of his helmet. Basically, if you saw this guy coming at you with the sword, you would probably die of fright.
Right.
At the very least, you would run.
Sure.
And I think that's kind of what it was intended for. You know, they had iron masks that went with the iron helmets.
Yes. Well, the helmet's called the Kabuto.
Right.
And like you said, they would often add the devil face, and they would add horsehair mustaches and little beards made out of horsehair on the front of the mask as well.
Yes, which makes them even scarier.
Yeah, and they're riveted together. You see the rivets. And does this? I got a picture of one here. I'm showing Josh. Does this look like anyone familiar?
It looks kind of like the Per Wellander Paul Peralta skateboard from the
80s. No.
Darth Vader, yes. Nice.
This helmet is absolutely, George Lucas absolutely modeled the Darth Vader look and helmet after the samurai Kabuto.
Yeah, isn't Jedi a Japanese word?
Yeah, and then the sword, the lightsaber was, we might as well talk about the swords since we're there.
The katana?
Yeah, the katana. And the wakizashi.
Which together is called the daisho. Which
yeah.
Dai is large, sho is small, and the katana is a larger sword, longer, and thinner blade.
Right.
And the wazekashi?
Yes.
Or wakizashi.
Wakizashi.
Thank you. is shorter with a broader blade, but you never saw a samurai without both.
Right.
And actually, you know why the katana is curved?
Because of the process of making it? No?
No, it was purposefully curved. Remember we talked about how horses played a pretty big role in samurai,
yeah.
an unsung role?
Uh-huh.
The curved blade made for a deeper slashing wound, which was inflicted by a horseback swordsman.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did you hold one that day at the meeting we took? People are like, you guys took a meeting where there was a samurai sword?
Yeah.
Remember at the School of Humans deal?
I didn't see that they had a samurai sword.
This guy brought in a samurai sword at the end for one of their little jobs coming up. And I held it
Where was I?
In my hand. You might have been in the bathroom or smoking. It's before you quit smoking.
Huh. Okay.
And I held this thing in my hand, and I've never held... Have you ever held a real samurai sword?
I was messing with a couple in Japan, but yeah.
I mean, it's like way heavier than I thought. Mm-hmm. And when you hold it and when you feel how sharp it is, you're like, this, I could literally cut you in half right now if I wanted
all
to.
All the ones that I was messing with were in like tourist shops.
Oh, they're yeah. little plastic keychain ones?
They were wood.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, it's really intimidating. It's extremely heavy, and you feel like the power of the sword when you hold it.
Right, and the smiths who made samurai swords are generally recognized as the greatest sword makers in the history of humanity.
Absolutely.
And one of the reasons why is not just because of these gorgeous, really heavy, perfect swords that they made.
Killing
machines. Again and again, yeah. Uh-huh. That you could actually cut someone's head right off with one slice.
Easily.
But they actually came, they created a technology or a method, a technique for an age-old problem, which was you want a sword with a sharp blade that won't break.
Right.
You can use a hard metal to keep a blade that will keep its edge,
uh-huh.
but it makes it a very brittle sword, so it'll break easily, right?
Yeah.
So what did they do?
Josh, they made a sword with a core made out of soft metal that wouldn't break. And then covered it with layers of hard metal that were folded and hammered. They hammer it to squeeze out impurities,
mm-hmm.
and they keep folding it repeatedly until mm-hmm. there's all these layers laminated together.
Right, like literally millions of layers.
Well, actually, this article has a slight mistake in it.
Does it?
That's lore. I looked this up. The when they fold a blade, they hammer it out, and uh-huh. there have been lore that they folded them hundreds of times and thousands of times to right. create millions of layers. Apparently, after anything over 20 folds adds no more layers.
Really?
That's what they said. So a 20-fold sword would have 1,048,576 layers.
Wow.
Which is, I mean.
So it's kind of like hammering a chicken that's been shot by a horseback archer.
You just can't make it any more dead.
It's just, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you talked about Kill Bill, though?
Yeah.
You know, you can buy a Hattori Hanzo sword on the internet, autographed by David Carradine, for $600.
I can't believe he's dead still.
I know.
Hung himself in a Bangkok hotel room.
It was fitting somehow, though.
Yeah.
Definitely. And odd.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can buy one of those for $600. Or if you don't want to spend that kind of dough, I think you can get like a functional katana for about $200 online.
Yeah. Or you can get a wood one from a tourist trap in Japan.
Yeah. Well, that's what they use for training, you know.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yes. You know, the whole, the cruel tutelage of Master Pei from Kill Bill.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And it's certainly Quentin Tarantino wasn't the first one to come up with the idea that samurai masters taught their students through, you know, rigid and brutal
methods.
Yes. That's been a recurring theme through samurai stories all along. Oh, and yeah. The reason why is because it's true. It really happened. There was one sword training master who used to walk around with a wooden katana
mm-hmm.
day or night, completely unprovoked and without warning, would smack his students
right.
pretty hard. Those things are hard. They hurt.
Oh, sure.
Like just holding it and like tapping it in your hand starts to hurt. So actually getting hit by one of these swords hurts bad. And if you get hit by one randomly, you learn pretty quickly never to let your guard down, which is what he was trying to impart.
Yeah, you could be like asleep. And get a sword upside the head.
You can be, you know, using the bathroom. And
right.
anything. Eating gruel.
Yeah, sure.
Be hammering a chicken that's been shot by a horseback archer.
Yeah, good point. Josh, they also used things called pole arms, which was a long pole with like a blade on the end of it. That was good for... stabbing at dudes on horseback. It gives you a little more reach, obviously.
Right.
And they even had guns. This is what, something I didn't know. In the 16th century, they started trading with Europe, Japan did, and they bought these matchlock guns and kind of kept them as backup, though. The samurai was like, I'll put a gun on my horse, but I'm not going to use it. I'm still going to use a katana.
Right.
Unless and I really need it.
It turns out they got those guns from European missionaries.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, who were kind of infiltrating Japan to try to start trade. Right. They were missionaries.
Sure, sure.
Everybody relax, we're just missionaries. But hey,
interesting.
Have you seen a gun before? Check this out.
This is my boomstick.
So, Chuck, one of the other characteristics of the samurai is this idea of a very noble, loyal life. And we said that the Kyuba no Michi
right.
was the foundation for Bushido. Right. Which means way of the warrior. Bushi is warrior, and mm-hmm. Do is the way, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the way of the warrior, and essentially it's just this code, this guide that was kind of put out by one samurai or another, and it formed the legend of the samurai, but it also informed the way they lived their lives, right?
Yeah, and it's a lot of people hear this, and they think it's like a formal set of rules that everyone followed, but it was actually different depending on who you were and where you had passed it down or gotten it from. And it wasn't even written down until the 17th century. So
right, there was a samurai named Yamamoto Tsunetomo, and he turned into a Zen monk, and he had a follower who he just basically dictated the tenets of Bushido to,
right.
And he wrote them down.
Darth Maul,
right. He
and
actually some of the high points of Bushido. Well, it covers everything from. Like life and death situations.
Right.
If you're presented with the choice, choose death, and
sure.
You can't ever go wrong. You'll never be afraid because you're always prepared for death.
I don't like the Bushido for that reason.
Right. It's a little,
yeah.
You know. And then to really kind of trivial matters, like you should never sneeze in front of somebody because it makes you look foolish.
Right.
And then my favorite is the lesson of the downpour, where, you know, like when you're being rained on, you're just so uncomfortable and you're running and you can't get wet. And oh my God, I can't get wet.
Sure.
So there's this Bushido tenet that says if you remind yourself that it is natural to get soaked in a rainstorm, that's what's supposed to happen in a rainstorm, you'll never run for cover again. You just get soaked. What's the problem?
Right.
And this can be applied to all aspects of life. That's my favorite one.
Yeah, I used to play in the rain. Like up until, you know, 6 or 8
years ago.
You're
trying to set fires?
No. I mean, as an adult, sometimes it's fun.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it.
Okay.
I didn't know I was following some samurai code.
Yeah, you were like right there. If you would be willing to die, Chuck, you would be a samurai.
No. I come from the Wham! Choose Life school. That's my code.
Nice.
Tiny running shorts and choosing life.
Nice.
I guess we have to talk about seppuku.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you were dishonored... then, yeah, you had to kill yourself.
Yes, otherwise known as, I didn't know it was a vulgar phrase, but harakiri.
Yeah, it essentially means gut cut.
Ah, no wonder, that is vulgar.
Well, vulgar also means common.
Oh, God, you're right. I feel like an idiot now.
Don't. I still am trying to figure out the Wham! Reference. So.
Yeah, when I think vulgar, I think of nasty words.
I know what you mean, but that's, again, it's common.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You're right.
Yeah.
So this is what you know, when you have seen the person thrust the sword into their gut, it sort of doesn't really happen that way. What happens is you got to wear the right garments, very ritualized.
White.
Oh, is it white?
Mm-hmm.
And they present you with a ritual knife wrapped in paper.
Right, to give you a better grip.
Sure.
Normally you're going to do this in a garden or a Buddhist temple, never a Shinto temple, because a Shinto temple is not to be tainted with death.
I would choose a garden.
Yeah.
That would be my pick. And you insert the knife into
First, you write a little death poem.
Okay.
And you take 4 sips of sake. 4 being she meaning, remember the Friday the 13th podcast
right.
in Japanese?
Yeah, yeah.
4 and death are the same kanji character.
Right.
So 4 is kind of like a pun on, hey, I'm about to kill myself.
Gotcha.
Okay, go ahead.
And then you can I plunge the sword into myself at this
Please
point?
Go ahead, Chuck.
So you plunge the sword into your belly. And you go from left to right. It's very important. And you do a little final upward cut at the end. And if you're lucky, and usually you're lucky, there was another samurai behind you with their sword to cut your head off really quick so you're not, like, writhing in agonizing pain.
Right. And that was... What's that samurai called?
The second in command is called the... Kashuku Nin.
Right. And if you were...
Kashaku Nin.
If you were forced to commit seppuku,
yes.
Right? Which was, you know, kind of routine.
You choose to, though, right?
No, you could be forced to.
Okay.
The Kashaku Nin would be assigned by the Bakufu.
Right.
The military dictatorship, right?
To end it quickly.
If you decided to do it yourself, then yeah, it was up to you to come up with a Kashaku Nin. And probably right. Who you would want would be a friend.
Yeah.
Right? And I've never heard of this before, an Iaijutsuka. This is somebody who had practiced drawing a sword, slashing it, and returning it to its... Oh, no. Drawing a sword, slashing, wiping it off, and returning it to its sheath in one fluid motion.
Wow.
And the Iaijutsuka
uh-huh.
could... basically, they could cut your head right off.
That's what you want.
With one slash. No.
You don't?
It's bad news for the second samurai.
Oh, but that's what you want as the...
Well, you want to be killed immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the point. But you didn't cut somebody's head right off. You would leave the throat, the skin attached to the throat,
because
it was bad form to cut somebody's head right off.
Because you don't want it rolling all around on the floor.
Yeah.
I wonder how those conversations went down. Like, hey, man, you want to do me a solid this afternoon?
Right.
I got to kill myself. And if you could be there to cut my head almost all the way off,
right,
I would really appreciate that.
And let's see, what else was there? Oh, if you were young... Or if they didn't think you could be trusted with a Wazukashi.
Right.
Wakuzashi.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The second sword.
Yes.
Sorry.
If you couldn't be, if like they were afraid you'd get up and kill everybody in the room rather than kill yourself.
Right.
They'd give you a paper fan.
Right.
And then the moment you touch the fan or touch the fan to your belly, whoosh, right?
See, I didn't know that was because of lack of trust. I thought it was just a tamer version.
It's both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then one last thing. I really was like, I want to understand seppuku.
Sure.
There's this type called Jumanji Giri. Jumanji.
Yeah.
And that was where you committed seppuku and you bled to death.
That was no backup sword.
Right. And the last guy to do this was General Nogi, who did it in 1912. Remember the Meiji Emperor?
That's after it was outlawed. Interesting.
Somebody's committed it as recently as 1970, but they had the backup samurai.
Right.
This guy did it himself. He cut himself in the ritual cut and then put his shirt on afterward and just sat and kneeled there and bled to death after the death of the emperor.
And the shirt just held all his guts in?
I guess.
Sort of like the horse diaper?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was officially abolished, though, in 1873, although, like you said, Japanese like to stick to their tradition, so... It has happened as recently as like the 2000s, right?
Oh, is that right?
I think
I saw was 1970, but yeah.
Oh, really?
Or maybe it started to make a resurgence in 1970, and it's still going on.
Yeah, well, I seem to think there was a head of some corporation that did it recently, but
really,
I can't confirm that.
That's a way to go.
Yeah, it's hardcore.
So, Chuck, we should probably talk about what happened to the samurai, right?
Yeah, where they went.
Well, let me talk about this one guy. First.
Okay.
Remember we were talking about warring clans and power struggles and everything? There was a huge civil war called the Sengoku, which was a civil war period in Japan, right? It was from like 1338 to 1603.
Right.
And in that year, Tokugawa Ieyasu grabbed control. And this guy, he was a Minamoto descendant, so he took the shogun title.
Sure.
And he kept the peace, his family kept the peace for 250 years.
Wow.
He kept a complete stranglehold on the other samurai, the daimyo.
Right.
He made it so that your family had to live in the capital.
Oh, that's that guy.
And you, right, and you lived like way out in the provinces.
He basically held families hostage.
Right. To keep the other daimyo under control, right? He also had a castle called Nijojo, and I've been in that castle, and we've talked about it before.
What?
Yes. Remember in the Ninja podcast, we talked about a guy who had a castle
that had
squeaky floors?
Yeah, yeah.
I've walked on those floors.
Did they squeak?
They sound like nightingales. They're called nightingale floors.
Did the ninja come down and kill you?
Cheep, 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 cheep. I tried walking on it. I got like two steps without making a sound.
Really?
So I could see a ninja possibly doing it, but it was random. Like wherever you stepped, like it was going to make the sound. It was pretty amazing stuff.
I don't think you and I would be candidates for ninja or samurai.
No.
Maybe sumo.
Possibly.
That's where I'm headed.
Or a geisha.
So, like you were saying, we got to talk about where they went, what happened to the samurai.
Yeah.
There was a 2.5 centuries of peaceful rule.
Yeah, under the Tokugawa family.
Right. So during that time, obviously, if you got peaceful rule, samurai are going to decline gradually just because there's no one to fight. And then the main two things, Josh, are urbanization and the end of their isolationism.
Right.
That's what really drove them out of business.
Yeah, because Tokugawa and his descendants didn't like the Europeans very much. And we're like, you guys need to beat it because we know how to cut someone's head off and just leave a flap of skin at the throat.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
So, yeah, they were isolationists. And then, all of a sudden, the Americans started going, you know, we'd like to trade with Japan.
Yes.
We get people who get shipwrecked around there somewhere, and we want to make sure they're taken care of, and we want to use this place as a supply port.
Yeah.
So we're going to sail over there.
Yeah. So in 1853, they Commander Chandler Bing sailed into Edo Bay. Is that not his name?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Commander Matthew Perry.
Right.
I had that wrong. He sailed over there to chat with the Millard Fillmore sent him to chat with the Emperor, who was a figurehead, but that's who, you know, you can't go talk to the Shogun. You got to go talk to the Emperor.
Right.
So he went and said just what you said. We want to open trade, and we want, if we get guys that are shipwrecked here, please take care of them and open your ports so we can, like, dock here and resupply.
Right. And
please.
Apparently when he showed up, he said, I'll be back in a couple of months. You guys talk it over, right?
Talk amongst yourselves.
But when he showed up with, you know, full cannons out, like guns. Everybody was basically strapped to the teeth.
He's like, think about it. See what you want to do.
But that, I guess that kind of intimidation really struck a chord with the Japanese, or some of the Japanese, who are like,
sure.
Whoa, what's been going on outside the borders of Japan while we haven't been paying attention?
Right, right.
And so there was a split in the samurai class where some wanted to go ahead and open up Japan and modernize Japan.
Right.
And this is the people in charge.
Right.
The lesser samurai didn't like that at all, so they actually went and staged a revolt, and the lesser samurai actually won.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
It was, because they beat the shogunate, which was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, very big deal.
Although they had gotten kind of fat and lazy in the 2.5 centuries of peace.
Yeah, that's true.
So the lesser samurai, who hadn't gotten quite as fat and lazy and comfortable, overthrew the shogunate and took the emperor and restored him to power, the Meiji Restoration.
Yeah, and that was it was actually a boy emperor. Emperor Meiji was, I think, like a teenager at the time.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure, but he
was young.
Yeah, he was boy king.
Yes. And now he makes a really good yogurt drink.
Oh, really?
You should try it.
What's it called?
Meiji.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the brand. They're like Nestle.
Gotcha. Yeah. So they overthrew, it was called the Nestle Restoration.
Right.
And the power of the daimyos was taken away. The government seized their land. There was no way to pay the samurai, so they basically started paying them off with bonds, depending on what their rank was.
Right, but it was like a, here's your settlement.
Yeah.
You know?
And go and don't be samurai anymore.
Right. They had basically turned into the modern, the equivalent of what in the modern era is somebody who falls in the grocery store and lays around watching Jerry Springer waiting for their settlement to come through.
Yeah, sort
that, of. That was kind of what happened at the end of the samurai.
It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
And in 1876, it finally culminated with the final blow, which was the emperor said, you cannot wear your swords anymore, and we're going to draft an army. So that was kind of like, no more use for you.
Right. And so there were some rebellions here or there. Tom Cruise shows up, and the rebellions in the outlying areas are crushed.
Top of gun.
And that was the end of the samurai. Japan became modernized, but it wasn't the end of the samurai spirit.
No. That lives on.
As Chuck said, there is a CEO that recently killed himself using seppuku, probably. but also, that it kind of informs Japan. There's that whole keep a stiff upper lip, don't complain kind of tradition and culture.
Right.
And you can argue that the history of the samurai is the history of Japanese culture.
Right.
Right. But also, in World War II, the Bushido was resurrected.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of perverted by the Japanese government and sold to the Japanese military, who would go crazy and kill everybody before they were killed.
Right. The kamikaze pilots?
Yeah, that was part of it.
Sure.
Was the Banzai guys?
Banzai guys.
And, just basically their whole death before dishonor.
Right.
Because it's like a suicide bomber today. If you're facing somebody who would rather die than lose, that's the most dangerous foe you have.
Right.
Yeah.
As opposed to the American way, which is do anything you can to save your butt.
Right. Or even go fall in the grocery store.
Right.
And see what somebody happens afterwards.
We would be remiss, Josh, before we leave, if we didn't mention a few movies, notably The Seven Samurai, 1956.
Right. Or The 37 classic. Ronin.
47. They
47
added
Ronin.
The sequel, they added 10.
Yeah.
And The Magnificent Seven, the awesome Western with Yul Brynner, was based on The Seven Samurai, but a Western version.
There's also Ghost Dog, which I've been meaning to see, but have not.
You haven't seen that?
No.
Oh, well, I was about to say, that's my favorite all-time, maybe favorite Jim Jarmusch movie. Definitely top two.
More than Dead Man, huh?
I think it's probably in a dead heat with Dead Man.
Nice.
It's awesome. You got to see Ghost Dog. That's where Forrest Whitaker is like sort of a modern day samurai living in New York, in Brooklyn, yeah. I think even.
Doesn't he raise pigeons?
Yeah, he's very peaceful. It's full of the Bushido, like it's broken up with him reading passages from the Samurai Code.
Right.
Pretty cool.
Nice. Okay, well, that's about it. If you want to see some pretty cool images of samurai armor and learn more about the samurai, including what a ronin is and what happened to the 47 ronin,
uh-huh.
You just want to type in samurai to the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com. So now, I guess then it's time for listener mail.
Yes, Josh, I'm going to call this the cutest kid in New Zealand. Hey, dudes, Chuck and Josh, this email comes to you from Felix from Wellington, New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
He's a cool kid.
Yeah.
I'm 9 years old, and I've listened to pretty much all your podcasts. Dad usually plays them in the car on long drives. The recent one on taxidermy I thought was seriously gross. I wish I could do a Kiwi accent. I'm not even going to try it, though.
No, I wouldn't if I were you.
I had a thought that you guys might want to do an episode on really long place names around the world and how that came about. And what do they mean? We have one in New Zealand called, and I won't even bother to say it because it looks like the alphabet, or it's just been written down in random order. I dare you to try and say it in your podcast, but Felix, I will not. But I did attach an MP3 of me saying it to impress you with my skills.
That's Felix speaking, not you.
Yes.
Okay.
You guys are cool and funny. And by the way, it translates roughly as the summit where Tamatia, the man with the big knees, the climber of mountains, the land swallower who traveled about, played his nose flute to his loved one. That's what this name translates to.
That's crazy.
So we got permission from Felix's dad since he's a little kid, and he said, go ahead and play it. So without further ado, here is Felix from New Zealand.
Hi, this is Felix here. Listen to this. Tama te whaka tangi hanga kawa wawa tama tia turi puka kapiki maunga horongu ku pokai whenua ki tana taho.
That is awesome. I'm glad we finally got around to playing that clip.
Yeah.
That kid is cool.
Very cute little kid there.
Well, I don't think we should make a call for audio files, do you?
No.
No. I think that one belongs to Felix, pretty much. He is his number's being retired in the Stuff You Should Know Hall of Fame. If you want to come up with something cool and interesting and clever and have your number retired, you should put it in an email. Send it to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode entitled How Samurai Work, originally podcast at howstuffworks.com on June 17th, 2010. You can subscribe to Stuff You Should Know and other podcasts at howstuffworks.com as well as on iTunes. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Down. Downtown Soulville Show, WFMU, with your host, Mr. Fine Wine. I'm spinning Soul 45s for you on a Friday night. It's my Friday night ritual, and I hope it's yours. Lots of great stuff tonight. Stay tuned.